life and legacy. And as we'll hear, it isn't just his art that captures people's imaginations, but also the tempestuous lifestyle that informed it, an example of which came shortly after he'd completed his great work, The Beheading of St John.
The picture is unveiled, but Vignacourt's party has been thoroughly spoiled. Caravaggio is in a rock-cut bell-shaped prison. Somehow, with ropes, he got out of this fortress. He scaled a 200-foot wall, got down to the main bay, swam round to a side bay where a corruptible skipper had somehow been paid, and the next thing we know is in Sicily.
Drama off and on canvas. Caravaggio is the subject of this week's essay, starting on Monday night at 11, here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news now, read by Vaughan Savage.
The Independent Police Complaints Commission is to examine the operation to find the gunman Raoul Moat, which ended when he killed himself with a shotgun last night. Armed officers from Northumbria Police had been involved in a six-hour standoff with Moat, who shot and wounded his former girlfriend, Samantha Stobart, and a police officer, and killed Miss Stobart's new partner. The Archbishop of York, John Sentamu, has called on the Church of England General Synod to end what he called the spin and propaganda against the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. Dr. Williams has been under pressure after the Crown Nominations Commission, which appoints bishops, blocked the appointment of a gay cleric, Geoffrey John, as Bishop of Southwark. Dr. Sentamu and Dr. Williams are trying to persuade members of the Synod to agree to a compromise on the ordination of women priests, I beg your pardon, women bishops, and prevent a split in the church. A Royal Marine who was killed in an explosion in Afghanistan on Thursday has been named by the Ministry of Defence. David Charles Hart of 40 Commando was on foot patrol in the Sangin district of Helmand province. He was the 101st member of British forces to die in the region. Israel has asked the United Nations for help to stop a Libyan aid ship from sailing to Gaza in breach of its naval blockade. The vessel is due to be sent from Greece by a charity headed by the son of the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi. Officials overseeing the clean-up of BP's oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico are hopeful that the spill could be contained by Monday. A new containment cap is being fitted to the damaged wellhead, and a new tanker will be used to collect oil. Botox has been approved as a way of preventing chronic migraines by drug regulators in the United Kingdom. Only patients who suffer headaches for at least 15 days a month will be eligible for the treatment. The weather, northern and western parts of the country should see some rain or showers this afternoon, but it will be dry, sunny and very warm elsewhere. It will be particularly hot in the southeast. The rain will continue in western England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland overnight. The BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by Vaughan Savage. Well, now on Radio 3, time for the Early Music Show today. It comes live from the York Early Music Festival, and that's where we join Catherine Bott.
Welcome to the National Centre for Early Music in York. Well, York, on this boiling hot day, is awash with bishops and racegoers for the race meeting and the synod, not necessarily in that order, but much more importantly for the cause of early music. The National Centre for Early Music is crammed. I won't say awash, because everyone looks very clean and nice. Crammed with friends and lovers of early music, both old and new. For a live early music show concentrating on this year's festival theme, which is musical marriages. So let's all imagine that this is the nicest kind of wedding breakfast where all the speeches are entertaining and the music is just what everybody wanted to hear from festival artists, and we'll have conversation with them as well. And we're going to kick off right away with Ifagellini in very festive style indeed. And here is the setup that they have asked me to read. You can guess what comes after I've read it. Old man Pantalone marches on and banks the dowry, which he's assembled to marry off his beautiful daughter to the old pedant Dr. Graziano. He's then planning a wedding celebration, but his hungry servant, Franca Trippa, instead makes a long list of his own bizarrely named family members that he wants to invite until Pantalone shuts him up. Dr. Graziano, the implausible groom, then arrives trying to strum some bagpipes. How do you strum a bagpipe? Discuss. He's really not very bright, but Pantalone offers him the score of a little madrigal to prepare for a teeny serenade. Music by Orazio Vecchi from his Lanfi Parnasso, performed by members of I Fagiolini, directed and really directed by Robert Hollingworth. For listeners at home, you're very unlucky because we here can see that Robert, as well as conducting the ensemble just then, ran us through an arsenal of Baroque gesture. And I would say he's joining me at the microphone, but he's actually at a microphone the other side of the hall. So hello, Robert.
I'm actually in Cheltenham, Kate.
Tell me. That piece has Parnassus, lofty home of the gods, in the title, but that was a really kind of all human life is here piece.
Yes, I think the clue is in the amphi, the twin peaks of Parnassus, and what Vecchi was claiming to do for the first time here was to mix comedy and humour. And so you have the beautiful lovers' madrigals, very serious Tuscan Italian, aping Gesualdo and Monteverdi's writing, with straight commedia dell'arte.
And we're going to have more from I Fagiolini and Lanfi Parnasso later in the show. Now, the York Early Music Festival has entertainments of sundry kinds for everybody's ears to delight in, but it always kicks off with a big event, and last night's was no exception. A really staggering performance of Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, which, as some of you may have noticed, is 400 years old this year. In the Minster, of all places, I mean, using the chapter house, using the whole panoply of acoustics available, and it was really a very exciting, well, more than a concert, it was an event. And here, we've eavesdropped and recorded what I might call a collage of material from this wonderful performance, which took place last night in York Minster. The opening of Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610 put gloriously into context, which after all is what historically informed performance is supposed to do. It doesn't always happen, but that sounded great. And the Yorkshire Baroque soloists and the Yorkshire Baroque choir were conducted there by Peter Seymour. Peter's a man of many parts, and he's actually on the stage now. In a minute, we're going to hear him tickling the ivories of the forte piano, but first, I want to talk to the festival's administrative director, Dr. Delma Tomlin, who is sitting beside me and is definitely not in Cheltenham or anywhere else they have festivals. Delma, festivals often have to have themes, and it's a pleasure, I remember from being one of your artistic advisors, to try to come up with themes every year. They don't always suggest themselves, do they? They have to be arrived at.
They do have to be arrived at, and the joy, of course, is to try and find a theme that embraces both all the artistic ideas that we have as a team, but also just really manages to just squeeze in the events that you really wanted to do all the time that don't really fit with anybody's theme but are a really good idea. And things like the 400th anniversary, of course, of the Vespers last night doesn't really fit in with musical marriages, although I would claim it did if anybody really asked me. But essentially, it was you couldn't have an early music festival in a place like York and not do those Vespers last night. And the joy, as you were saying, of having the Minster and the Chapter House, the spaces, the acoustic opportunities, if you like. And we had the great benefit of having five monks from Ampleforth College who just chant naturally, every day, that they don't have the music in front of them, they just have the words, and off they go, and they were wonderful.
So they were the real thing, but actually there is a marriage in the Monteverdi Vespers of the sacred and almost the profane, I mean, certainly the secular, the sensuous.
I can see why you used to be an advisor. Well, not used to be, you'd still be one, actually, on that basis.
Well, the art song is one of the great musical marriages, the marriage of music and words. And Peter Seymour, whom we're going to hear accompanying Barbara Schlick in a minute, has long been a great champion of Lieder, and not the Lieder that everyone knows, the lesser known and should be more loved and appreciated works by composers like Zelter and Zumsteeg and Reichardt, who in many cases actually inspired the composers we've all heard of, like Schubert and Schumann. So we're going to hear them both in two songs, both Goethe settings. And first, Barbara is going to sing Reichardt's setting of Goethe's poem from Faust, Gott. It's a meditation on God and the nature of God. And the poet says, doesn't matter what you call him, God is everything. And secondly, we're going to hear them both in Zelter's Wanderes Nachtlied, which is the plaintive prayer of a traveller at night who really longs only for day to break and some peace and rest in his life. Unterwinden zu sagen, ich glaube in dir, der soprano Barbara Schlick and fortepianist Peter Seymour with two Lied by Zelter and Reichardt. And tomorrow they'll be in recital here in the National Centre for Early Music at 1 o'clock with tenor James Gilchrist in a programme that very appropriately for anniversaries and for the theme of this festival is a celebration of that wonderful and ultimately tragic marriage of Robert and Clara Schumann. Sitting beside me is the festival's administrative director, Delma Tomlin. We've done themes, but Delma, another thing we can't avoid is acronyms. Even the York Early Music Festival becomes YEMPF, which is rather ugly, but quicker. And you've been hosting this year REMA.
We have. We've been hosting the European Early Music Network Conference. The Europeans got together 10 years ago in Ambrenet, in France. I don't know if all of you have ever been there. Amazing festival. And gradually, over the years, there are 65 member festivals across 20 different European states. So it's quite something. So to celebrate 10 years of that sort of success and growth has been tremendously interesting. And I'm very lucky because as a member of that, I get to travel around these different festivals and see a lot of people and enjoy a lot of very nice occasions.
And this time they've all come to you and some of them are in this room, I believe.
They are indeed. And we had a remarkable conference yesterday afternoon, just really about the future of early music. And it's just wonderful to talk to lots of people really about one's own pet subject for a change, and they're equally interested in this.
Well, I think it's a very daring title this forum had, Early Music, The End of a Movement. Now, that's really a hostage to fortune, but it obviously produced some very stimulating discussion, and we've got a little recorded package of quotes from some of the eminent delegates to give you a flavour of the event, which begins with the chair of the event, Professor John Bryan of Huddersfield University, who told me this morning that actually, in REMA terms, he's known as a moderateur.
I think the main thing is that it's such an exciting area to be in early music. We've been looking at whether the movement of early music has come to an end, whether we're now mainstream, and in fact the answer is we're much more widely accepted than we were, but there's an awful lot of work still to be done, particularly in repertory that perhaps isn't so familiar. The amazing thing is the breadth of activity that's represented here. We've had 31 different festivals from all over Europe coming together to discuss the future of early music and their programming, and it's a very exciting place to be.
50 years ago, as a musician who tried to play this music, I have to read all the treatises and all the books of the 16th, 17th century to know. And little by little, it was really actual, you see, because their mind plays music and not the treatise they have just read.
I think that the young people don't come in our concert. I think we must try to focalize this idea about the young people and try to find another not academic style and be new also the old generation. New thing is that you study some 8-10 years in school, but it's just like you repeat what you heard, your professor. I think, yeah, we must be very new how we try to push this young generation to find new things.
I think this conference was very interesting because 50 years ago, early music, we didn't know what it is. We need, little by little, to understand. And now, we ask the question, is there a future or is it finished? My answer is, we need another 50 years to be ready to play it correctly.
Well, food for thought there from Philippe Bosson, the musicologist, and Chiara Banchini, a director of Ensemble 415. And judging by the smiling faces in the hall, I think all the audience here is ready for another 50 years. What about you, Delma?
Perhaps not quite 50, Kate, but certainly there was so much to talk about, and that very interesting discussion about how different countries try and encourage younger people. We heard Chiara there talking about young people not necessarily coming to early music concerts. And we got into an interesting discussion about why that might be and how you might encourage them. And obviously from our point of view, as you all know, working with BBC Radio 3, we have things like the Young Composers Award, which is specifically designed to attract young composers who wouldn't perhaps think of early music as being their thing to write for the instrument or the voices or whatever that we put in front of them. And we've had such success with that that we found that a really encouraging way. And obviously we also work a lot with jazz and folk and world music.
And just to encourage you, should you have nothing better to do, you people here in York, you will of course be listening to Barbara Schlick and Peter Seymour, but people at home may care to know that tomorrow's early music show at 1 o'clock will be devoted to the Young Composer Award. It's a really exciting event. Well, another person on the panel for REMA discussing the future or the past of early music was Robert Hollingworth, who's back on his microphone at the other side of the hall. And Robert, Ifagellini, you've always done a lot to offer really quite cool and groovy programmes that any young person could enjoy. The Full Monty, Talis in Wonderland, fabulous punning titles with really sound musicology behind them.
It's interesting. We've never thought about how can we get the young people in. I think that would be, I suppose, dangerously patronising. But what I always imagine is that my mum's listening in the audience and she has absolutely no specialist knowledge of this period at all. So I would want to make the whole event inclusive. And some of the music that Ifagellini particularly does, music before 1600, the social customs, the milieu have changed so much that if you're going to make a commercial living doing this repertoire, you have to think, how does an audience receive it? And that, I still always start with the how would it originally have been done. I still go back to, you know, a treatise, go back to as much we know about contemporary audiences that would have been listening to it. But it's how do you make that work for an audience now that has to be the end point.
And your production of L'Anfi Parnasso, we're going to hear a little bit more from that now. How does that fit in chronologically and artistically with these wonderful shows like Full Monty?
It's substantially early. It's 2003. We were already 17 years old by that time. We'd had our groundbreaking tour to South Africa, which made us really want to put the scores down and communicate directly with any sort of audience. And we'd done a couple of programmes, a couple of operas with Peter Wilson, Purcell's Indian Queen and Handel's Acis and Galatea, one of which we did masked and the other which we did with puppets, which was absolutely fascinating. We'd done a couple of magical comedies, and I think it's fair to say that a lot of magical comedies are a great fun if you're performing them, but if you don't speak Venetian dialect or maybe the Bolognese version that Pantaloni calls called minestrone, if you don't speak these things, and even if you do, you don't know who the characters are. Now, Vecchi specifically in L'Anfi Parnasso says, in the prologue, he says, this is not a comedy for the eyes, but for the ears, so be silent and listen. Well, that's great if you've got a Modenese audience from 1594, but for a contemporary audience, they need to see the characters, they need to at least know who the characters are, so we decided to stage it much the way that his contemporary Banchieri suggests for his magical comedies, which is with the singers to one side, providing all the music and the characterisation, the vocal characterisation of the voices, and then have their masked characters on stage actually miming the music. Very specifically to each phrase of the music. This is why we couldn't get a commedia group in to work with us unless we'd had money for 2 years. because every action happens really fast like that, following the music.
Millionaire benefactors, please note that was a heavy hint from Robert Hollingworth.
Ifagellini.com.
Now, what are you going? Never mind the plug. What are you going to perform for us now? Can you set the scene?
Yes.
And remember, this is a lunchtime broadcast.
Yes. Commedia dell'arte certainly has its earthy side. So I've been told to be gentle, especially as it's Sunday lunchtime listening. I think the Timothy Knapman's spoken introductions, I think, set the scene up. This is a suicide aria. One of their lovers has decided to throw himself off a cliff. Come, gather round, people, and nobody scoff. Lucio's romance has entered a trough. Isabella has left him, so please your hats doff. I must end it all, says he with a cough, and looks for a cliff top to toss himself off.
Miserable. Señors, señoras, and señoritas, put down your tapas and your fajitas, and welcome the Capitan all Spaniards greet us, one of our greatest romantic world beaters. The dashing, the handsome, I do beg his pardon, the one and the only himself, Capitan Cardon. Cross him in love, and he'll send his armada, and his abrada, and his afarda. He's like Don Quixote, gallant but wonky, with less of the hoti and more of the donkey. Cardon is in love with the fair Isabella, and outside her house here is waiting to tell her. His servant, Azanido, gets in the way and misunderstands what he's trying to say. The servant is trying to give of his best, but poor Cardon's patience is put to the test. Happiness now would fill Cardon's cup if Zani, his servant, would just knock her up.
Music both sublime and ridiculous, and wasn't it wonderful, by Orazio Vecchi, performed there by members of I Fagiolini, directed by Robert Hollingworth, who also introduced, proving that he's today York's answer to Antonio Banderas.
Their concert is tonight at the Jack Lyons Hall at the University. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, coming live today from the National Centre for Early Music in York with a capacity crowd in a warm hall. Nathan, the festival's resident guide dog, has just shown that it is a little bit hot for him by getting up and turning round. He is an impeccably behaved friend of the festival. I don't think I could do it without him, really. But it is hot, isn't it, Nathan? And with me still is Delma Tomlin, Administrative Director of the festival. And something I want to ask you, Delma, in this exciting week when I see in the newspaper that, along with various worldwide ancient monuments and natural wonders, in contention for election as UNESCO World Heritage Site, is the entire city of York. Not just one place in York, not just the Minster, but the whole place. I mean, you go round York and round every corner, there is something of staggering beauty to delight you. Delma, does that make the choice of venues for festival concerts easier or harder?
That's a difficult one, Kate, because obviously the part of the festival's raison d'etre is to show off the wonderful venues that are the City of York. And certainly years ago, when I first came to the city, we could use some really beautiful little tiny venues, which these days wouldn't be deemed accessible or worse, are marred by noise, which has nothing to do necessarily with the roads or perhaps just a pub round the corner, which has just a little bit of loud music, which makes it perhaps less possible for us to use. So what we, I suppose, tend to focus on, apart from here at the centre and the obvious Minster and Chapter House, are the more hidden churches, the ones which are just down a little snickle way, as we call it here in York, and are quiet, so that when we have an early music concert, we're not disturbed by what's going on outside, really, and that is an issue.
And I think we can guarantee that tomorrow's little event from South Africa will not be allowed to disturb any early music going on at all, whether you support Holland or Spain. Well, talking of venues, we've already mentioned the glories of the Minster and the particular octagonal splendours of the Chapter House. And now on the stage, Peter Seymour has returned to play the organ, and with him is cornetto virtuoso Roland Wilson, who himself will be performing in the Chapter House in the festival this year. And they're going to play two pieces for us together, beginning with Giovanni Martino Cesare's La Focarina. Roland Wilson, accompanied by Peter Seymour in that little workout from the early Italian Baroque for cornetto. Roland, this is really a year to play the cornetto, isn't it? All these performances of Monteverdi's Vespers. You have a very busy life with your own ensemble, Musica Fiata, that's playing in the festival. Do you still play the Vespers of Monteverdi?
Well, no, actually. yesterday was an exception. It's the only one that I played this year. I'm directing a few with the ensemble, and I decided, after I've played it over 300 times, enough is enough.
So York was very lucky to have you last night. Well, tell me about your concert on Wednesday in the Chapter House. It's called Wedding Motets and Songs of Love, and it's all music from 17th century Germany.
Yes, it was a very useful possibility for composers in during the 30 Years' War to publish music for weddings, or at least they weren't often written specifically for the wedding, but it was possible then to get money to print the composition, which otherwise would not have been possible. The other possibility was funerals, but they usually weren't large-scale pieces. And otherwise, during the 30 Years' War, the composers had no really possibility to publish any of their larger-scale works at all.
So you're combining in this concert with the nine members of your own instrumental ensemble with five singers of La Cappella Ducale. So it's going to be quite a large-scale concert. How have you been to see the Chapter House yet?
Yes, we were there. We played there 2 years ago. We performed a Requiem by Johann Rosenmüller. And yes, well, it's just the Chapter House will be big enough for us, but we have to have the stage big enough that we can play sort of up to three choir music with three little ensembles.
And what are you going to play for us right now as a soloist? Because we're obviously very lucky to have you with cornetto in hand. It's a piece by Elias Nikolaus Amerbach, and I want you to explain its title to me.
Oh, well, Amerbach was an organist at the Thomaskirche, where Bach worked in Leipzig in the 16th century. And he called this piece Der Friesische Tritt oder Gallia, that means the Frisian step or kick or something. But actually, it is based on Frais et Gaillard, Frisch and Lively, by Clemens non papa, which means Clemens was not my father, I suppose.
That's a complicated story, obviously. Let's hear the piece.
Thank you.
Roland Wilson and Peter Seymour, and Roland's concert with his ensemble Musica Fiata and La Cappella Ducale will be taking place in the Chapter House of York Minster on Wednesday at 7:30. It's going to be recorded for a future early music show, and I'll tell you a bit more about our role here a little bit later. But still with me is Delma Tomlin, and I want to ask you about going to Harwood, because we don't just stay in York, do we, at the York Erna Music Festival?
No, we travel about.
Which is the new world, really, isn't it?
A whole new world, exactly. We're going, as you say, to Harwood to quite specifically celebrate a new project that we're involved in, which is to do with the Cultural Olympiad leading into the 2012 Games. And part of what the Games are about, obviously, is getting people who perhaps wouldn't work together, different communities, to think about interacting. And on a cultural level, that means here in Yorkshire that we're working with the National Media Museum and with the Northern School of Contemporary Dance and Harwood, and Bradford Museums, and an organisation that's bringing all that sort of different disciplines together. So when we're at Harwood, we not only have a great pleasure of listening to a wonderful new piece, actually, which is written by Orlando Goff, and about Francis Drake and circumnavigating the globe and mixing old and new and this, that and the other. We also have a chance to look at some of their miniatures, which are about really brought back from all over the world, and starting to think about migration and just different horizons, if you like. So the next 2 years are for us really a time of exploration. Great fun. I'm sure it's going to be fun.
Well, it really demonstrates something that is not unique to early music, but it really is a consistent feature of, well, early musicians and the serendipitousness of programming. I was talking to Richard Boothby of Fretwork a couple of months ago about this programme, and it seems in part to have originated from the discovery, because you need to go into other disciplines, read round your subject, as people used to be told to do, that Francis Drake had a consort of viols, or a chest of viols, with him on his round-the-world voyages. And so after a hard day's navigating, or storms at sea, or looking out for sea serpents, there was viol music in the evenings. I don't know who played, but that set off a train of investigation, and we have this wonderful programme.
Absolutely, and apparently, although I'm sure it's not really true, part of the reason for taking a viol consort with you, or musicians, is to prove to whoever it is land that you've, as it were, landed on, that you're quite friendly. Because obviously, if you've got a viol consort, by the time you've unpacked all that, you're not really going to be an aggressor, are you? Or not a very successful one at that point. There we go.
No, they come heavily armed with viols. Well, unfortunately, as this concert hasn't yet taken place, we are recording it for a future edition of the Early Music Show. We can't play you any of it, but really, we should be hearing Fretwork. So here are Fretwork on disc.
Thank you.
Well, I guess it's only fair to say that Francis Drake might have been a bit alarmed by the avant-garde nature of that music. It's actually by Bach, as I'm sure most of you have already divined. It's Contrapuntus 2 from his Art of Fugue, transformed into wonderful viol consort music by the Art of Fretwork on that CD. And their concert at Harwood. Oh dear, I can't remember which day it's on, but it's later in the festival. Actually, if you're not here in the National Centre for Early Music with us, do look on the festival's website, because it's only in its second day and doesn't finish till next Saturday, and there may be concerts that aren't sold out. So do look that up. And the Early Music Show will, and I are here for the duration of the festival, so I'm looking forward to catching up with a lot of festival friends. I shall be attending just about every concert, not exactly everyone, and we're going to be recording 7 of them, I think. And the first 4, for listeners at home and you here in the hall, are going to be broadcast across the last week in September and the first week in October. Meanwhile, highlights, as far as I'm concerned, at the end of the festival in particular, we've got new generation artist, Radio 3 new generation artist, the wonderful harpsichordist Mahan Esfahani, who's giving the lunchtime recital on Friday the 16th. And the 16 are in town on Friday and Saturday next. And as well as giving a wonderful concert and having an insight day and doing events with schools, we're working them really hard because we're doing a Discovering Music with Harry Christopher's, joined by Sally Dunkley, one of the singers who has edited the music that they'll be performing, and I'll be presenting that right here in the National Centre, so do be here, and that'll be broadcast later in the year. And on Saturday the 17th, the festival comes to the most glorious, sumptuous and sensuous end with a concert of works by John Blow, performed by the Theatre of the Air, directed by Elizabeth Kenny, and it's going to end with a performance of that ultimate erotic treat, the opera Venus and Adonis. No marriage, but it's a real marriage of sense and sensuality. And one of my favourite elements is that apart from an all-star cast, our own Minster Minstrels are going to be playing the Little Cupids. So that's going to be really well worth listening to. And that's going to crop up on Radio 3 as well in October. Now, from the ridiculous to the sublime, in the seat so recently vacated by Delma Tomlin, we have James Bowman. Later today, he's going to be presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the York Early Music Festival. And James, welcome.
Thank you.
You've come up by train and enjoyed an at-seat dining experience on the way, so you're ready to sing for us in a minute. But first of all, I want to ask you, I gather you're writing your memoirs.
Well, I've started, yes, but and today is very poignant for me in a way because I've been writing the chapter, or started the chapter, on David Munro. And he's very much in my thoughts at the moment. And I know David would have loved an occasion like this. He'd have rejoiced in it. He'd have probably actually been, I hesitate to say it, running it. You never know with David. He had a way of appearing, didn't he, in various disguises. But I'm very conscious of him today, and I would hope that he's looking down from somewhere, with his diary, of course, on me, and I hope he'd be pleased for the great honour that is being bestowed upon me today. But, no, I'd like to really just think about David a lot today, because he's much in my thoughts.
I think it's very hard to meet anybody in early music and without his name cropping up. It is a very long time now, more than 34 years since he so sadly was taken from us much too young. But he was a real galvaniser, wasn't he?
Well, he was, and the amazing thing is that it's almost as if he died yesterday, because he was so vivid in the imagination. It's almost as if he was still here. I really haven't forgotten him at all. You know, people die and things move on, but David is so very much a presence, and I can even hear his voice now.
Well, I'm very glad to say that you, James Bowman, are still here in actuality. You are not down the line from Cheltenham, and you're sitting beside me, but now you have to work for this award.
Thank you. You're
going to play us out and sing us out of today's show. My thanks to all the guests who have made this show so lively, from Nathan to Delma. And James Bowman is now just heading across to the other side of the stage, where he's going to be accompanied by lutenist David Miller in Dowland's beautiful song, His Golden Locks.
His golden locks, time ahead to silver tend. A time to swift, a swiftness never.
countertenor James Bowman and lutenist David Miller in Dowland's His Golden Locks. And that ends today's Early Music Show. It was live from the York Early Music Festival, and it was presented by Catherine Bott.
Join me, Julian Joseph, tomorrow night for Jazz Lineup, coming from the grounds of the Dankworth Residence in Wavendon at the annual Music in the Garden series. The Million Dollar Collection is an ambitious suite for large ensemble, inspired by paintings from artists including Mondrian, Picasso, and Hogarth. The late Johnny Dankworth wrote it in 1967, and this week we'll hear it performed by a brand new band of top-class musicians, assembled and conducted by his son, Alec. An exclusive performance of a truly unique piece, Dankworth's Million Dollar Collection, tomorrow night in Jazz Lineup at 11:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this afternoon. It's coming up to 2:03. And time now for another chance to hear last Monday's live Wigmore Hall lunchtime concert. The presenter is Fiona Talkington.
The Canadian-born violinist Lila Josefowicz has built up something of a reputation for her searing performances of Shostakovich. She's chosen his dark and brooding violin sonata for her programme today with pianist John Novacek, a piece which she says is a bit of a beast. And they balance that with Schubert's lyrical Rondo Brillant in the second half of the concert. Shostakovich wrote the sonata for David Oistrakh's 60th birthday. He wasn't expecting anything particularly festive as a birthday present, but maybe he wasn't anticipating anything like this sonata's unremittingly sombre and introspective mood. That was in 1968. Oistrakh's phenomenal playing had inspired Shostakovich the previous year to write his second violin concerto. He'd become fascinated by the concept of serialism and the 12-note row, drawn in by the harmonic possibilities it offered. But glimpses of his trademark sounds and rhythms leave us in no doubt where the music's coming from. A pounding middle movement gives way to a monumental passacaglia which inhabits the world of Bach. And you can't help drawing comparisons with a mighty chaconne from Bach's third solo partita. Well, Lila Josefowicz has been building up a reputation for her performances of Shostakovich and her recording of the first concerto and the sonata quite a few years ago. And here she is now with John Novacek coming onto the stage to perform Shostakovich's violin sonata in G, opus 134.
Thank you.